I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Millions of people have read Dan Brown's bestseller, The Da Vinci Code, but the plans to turn it into a movie may be delayed by accusations that parts of the book were borrowed. The authors of a 20-year-old nonfiction book entitled The Holy Grail and the writer of another novel, The Da Vinci Legacy, are said to be considering their options. In recent years, well-known historians and academics have all been accused of plagiarism. The accusations seem to be everywhere. Well, now there's another case, only this one has a twist. Malcolm Gladwell is a writer with The New Yorker. He recently discovered that a piece he'd written, a profile of a prominent psychiatrist, had been extensively copied for the stage by a British playwright. While Gladwell initially accused the writer of theft, he began to have second thoughts. And he's written about those thoughts in a follow-up article called Something Borrowed. You can find it in The New Yorker on newsstands today. Malcolm's joining us today to talk about the legal and the moral aspects of plagiarism and copying and copyright. We'd like to have you join us. Who does own words? Is it the writer who puts them together in the first place? And when is the borrowing of a phrase or a sentence or a paragraph actually stealing? Is there any such thing as an original idea? The number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, joining us this hour, Justin Hughes is a professor of law at the Cardozo Law School in New York. He's going to be helping us navigate some of the more legal aspects of this. Justin also teaches intellectual property and internet law. Good to have you with us, Justin.
Thank you.
I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to relax while we get caught up to date on this story, because sitting with you there in the same studio is Malcolm Gladwell, staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest article, the one that I was talking about, is called Something Borrowed. Hi, Malcolm.
Good morning.
Let's just talk quickly about the original story that you'd written back in 1997, a piece called Damaged. It was a profile of this psychiatrist, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her name was Dorothy Lewis. And she taught at New York University School of Medicine and also at Yale. And she was someone who had devoted her life, her career, to studying serial killers and trying to understand why they acted the way they acted. And her argument was that when you look very closely at most people who were convicted of these kinds of crimes, they had an extraordinary history of neurological damage and psychiatric dysfunction and child abuse and... So that was what the profile was all about.
And then, as it turns out, this play, Frozen, features a New York psychiatrist who studies serial killers, who has, what, almost exactly the same notions, ideas, arguments about how they get that way?
Yeah, this play, which was written in the late 1990s and came to New York in about 2 years ago and was on Broadway this summer, basically uses the character... has a character that's clearly based on Dorothy Lewis. And
that's not an issue, is it? I mean, nobody's arguing that?
No, I don't think anyone... No one is arguing that.
Okay.
The issue is that the play includes 675 words that are basically taken verbatim from the profile I wrote of Dorothy Lewis.
How did you make this discovery? Was it with a copy of the script, or did you go to the play?
No, Dorothy Lewis found out. A bunch of people would see the play, and they kept telling her that she ought to see it because they felt that she would really like it, or she'd find, you know, some. And she kept on saying, you know, she wasn't interested. Finally, the play, the theater, invited her to do a talk back. And to prepare for the talk back, she got a copy of the play, read it, realized how much it borrowed from her work, and then went to see the play, and was, she made the discovery then, and then I was told after that.
And then you saw a copy of the script as well.
Mm-hmm.
Were you surprised by the similarities? I mean, did they jump out at you?
Well, you know, I'd written this play, this article so long ago that I would never have caught it on my own. I perhaps would have caught the resemblance to Dorothy Lewis, but. Dorothy actually sat down and went through my article, a book she'd written, and the play, and picked out all of the overlapping segments. And that's when I learned about how extensively my article had been used in Frozen.
And you describe two very conflicting reactions that you have to this discovery. The first one is the sort of natural, what I would, you know, the sense of outrage. Somebody's stolen my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the other one?
Well, the other one was, I mean, I knew that's how I was supposed to react. One's supposed to be upset when one's plagiarized. So I wrote this letter to the playwright, Byron E. Lively, complaining, essentially saying, you stole my work and you should have asked me first. And then I began to realize I didn't feel angry. I said that she had stolen something from me, but in fact, I didn't feel like anything had been stolen from me. It's not like if she'd taken my computer, I would have been upset because then I wouldn't have a computer anymore. But she took my words and I still have my words. And then I read the play and realized I really liked the play. And she had used my words as a very, very small piece of constructing a really powerful and original work of art. And somehow that made it a lot different for me. And I realized that I wasn't upset at all. In fact, I was kind of proud in a certain way to be a part of this, even though she didn't ask me, but that seemed to me a matter she was impolite, I suppose. But I don't know why I should be required to be upset about somebody constructing a work of art using some small piece of something that I'd done many years ago.
Did you ever even think about suing the playwright?
No, legal action was contemplated and is still, I believe, ongoing on the part of Dorothy Lewis, but I have declined to be a part of it, and I didn't even contemplate it. I have no interest in suing anybody.
For the reasons that you just explained.
Even if I was upset, I just don't believe that, with all due respect to my colleague here in the studio, I don't believe in getting lawyers involved if at all possible.
Going to get this lawyer involved right now. Yes. Justin, you know the story. If Malcolm had wanted to sue this playwright for taking literal parts of the article, would he have had a case?
He might have had a case. But the interesting thing about this article is at least the passages that are directly quoted in the play The Frozen, they come from two places. Some of them come from Malcolm, and some of them come from Dr. Lewis. To the degree Malcolm was just quoting Dr. Lewis, and that is actually verbatim or almost verbatim appearing in the play, think of it very commonsensically, that's not Malcolm's creativity. Those are Dorothy Lewis's words. He was just reporting them. If I report a speech by John Edwards, it doesn't suddenly become my copyrighted words. To the degree the play was just taking things that Malcolm was reporting Dr. Lewis said, Malcolm really wouldn't have a claim. But on the other hand, to the degree it was taking his expression, his expressive analysis of what Dr. Lewis's life was about, that would be where his claim was.
That's where I'm lost. Now, you're on one hand quoting her using the words that he used in the article. You're saying it's a little bit dodgy, but his expression. What's the difference between the two that I need to understand here?
Well, copyright law draws one of the ways it reconciles itself with a system of free expression and free speech is that it draws a dichotomy between expression and ideas. And it says that the exact expression of an author is protected by the copyright, but the ideas are not. So if I write a short story and have an interesting character in it, you are free to assemble a similar character using the same ideas as long as you don't use my expression, my words. And obviously drawing this line between expression and idea gets very complicated.
This is like the Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story comparison, right?
Exactly. Exactly. The idea is that Romeo and Juliet and West Side Story are really at a sufficiently high level of abstraction. They're the same basic idea. Star-crossed lovers from divergent, conflicting clans. And you can say, in a sense, they're the same story, but obviously in terms of expression, they're radically different stories.
Now, Malcolm Gladwell, the last time we talked, we were talking about your book, The Tipping Point, which got you a lot of attention. And I'm wondering if some filmmaker or some playwright had taken the title, the idea, the your expression there, would you have had the same kind of attitude about that?
I have two reactions. One is that someone did do that.
Okay.
A couple of business school professors published something called The Principles of the Tipping Point, using as their case study the cleaning up of New York City and the actions of the police department, which was a chapter of my book.
They're in jail now, though, those two professors, I hope.
No, they're you can buy it on Amazon. And I was sort of, you know, I kind of rolled my eyes when I saw it and thought they really ought to get a life. But I, you know, I mean, that was a little bit more upsetting. But one of the things that wasn't upsetting about the Lavery case is that, going to what Justin just said, is that looking very closely at what was taken, I didn't feel that any of the things that were taken weren't examples of great creativity on my part. They were either, as he points out, just quotes that I'd gotten from Dorothy Lewis,
right,
or they were really kind of boilerplate descriptions of physiological functions. There's a whole section about the cortex that she took, which is just kind of technical language. And, you know, where did I get it? I got it from a textbook somewhere. You know, it's not the kind of thing where, it's not like she took a sonnet I'd written for, you know, my loved ones and rewritten. You know, she took stuff that was pretty banal from my standpoint. And that strikes me that should be part of the argument, that there's a distinction between taking stuff that you're really proud of and stuff that's kind of, you know, boilerplate. And this falls into the latter category.
And Justin, does the law see that same distinction, the author's pride versus some more technical definition of ownership?
I think generally speaking, the law tracks a lot of artists' and writers' intuitions in this area. Of course, you can have an artist or a writer who is, you know, gone off the deep end in terms of thinking he or she, every word that comes out of their pen is glistening golden prose. But I think Malcolm's intuition is basically right, that where you feel that what you did was pretty boilerplate, was pretty garden variety description of something, it won't actually merit protection under copyright law. Copyright law protects original expression. So if the expression is really boilerplate, if it's really garden variety, if it's really common and has occurred many times before, it probably doesn't merit protection. On the other hand, as I said, this be a radically different case if Malcolm had written a short story about this kind of interesting character who has spent her life studying serial killers and the psychological impact it's had on her, et cetera, et cetera. And if that character were taken verbatim by someone put into play, yeah, it'd be a much stronger case.
Okay, now, Dorothy's not a guest on the program, and I don't want to dwell on her place and her role, but if she was asking you, Justin, do I have a case because it's her character through Malcolm's article and her own life that appears in the play, is her case any stronger?
Well, her case is different. First, there's a question about whether she'd have any claims under copyright law, and then there's questions of whether she'd have any claims under what we call the right of publicity.
Is that like a privacy thing?
It's partly privacy. The right of publicity starts rooted in privacy, but is really taken on its own life, both in common law and in statutory law in the U.S. So it's it would be interesting to analyze her case. I don't think it's a particularly strong case, but it would have those two prongs.
When we come back after the break, we're going to include you, our callers, in our conversation about the ownership of words, the sort of common understanding that we have of copyright and plagiarism and when something is borrowed and whether or not this is all about technology and those sorts of changes that we now have to deal with. Take a look at blogs, for example. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, questions about plagiarism, copyright, the morals, the ethics, the legalities of what you own and what you don't when you put words on paper. Justin Hughes teaches intellectual property and internet law at the Cardozo Law School in New York City. He's with us, as is Malcolm Gladwell. Now, back in 97, Malcolm wrote a profile of a prominent psychiatrist called it Damaged, and found then that the number of words were that from that appeared in the play Frozen by a British playwright, and has written his own thoughts and reactions to that borrowing in an article, which is today on the newsstands in The New Yorker, called Something Borrowed. Our number is 423-8255. I'd like to have you in on our conversation about what's right and what's wrong here. We're going to start in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, with Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine. What do you think?
Fascinating discussion, by the way. My question, I'm working on an essay right now on Jack Kerouac's On the Road, published in 1957. And one of the fascinating things, the opening sentence of that novel lifted almost directly from, well, several sources, but Edgar Allan Poe's Man of the Crowd, which was, you know, published, I think, in 1845-46, mm-hmm. Which itself was had most of the ideas, if not, you know, whole sentences and words borrowed from an earlier work that appeared in a magazine. So my question is, with literature itself, you know, we've basically seen that, where does the difference between borrowing an idea and taking that sort of to the next level?
I get the point that you're making. I mean, Kerouac takes whatever you have marked those connections to previous work and made them something different, something his own. I mean, we could talk about Canterbury's Tales, for goodness sakes, but I mean, Justin Hughes, is there a way of moving aside the weeds on this and saying, here's what you need to know?
Sure. Let me give you some different ways to move the weeds. First of all, copyright is limited in term, and many people think that the copyright term today is too long. But for everything in the 19th century and much of stuff in the early 20th century, the copyright has expired, meaning that you're free to take Edgar Allan Poe. You're free to take the words as well as the ideas. You're free to take the words and the ideas of Samuel Clemens. You're free to take the words and ideas of all that.
Although
enormous.
When he was alive, he was a real stickler about that, wasn't he?
When he was alive, he was really protective of his words. But all that rich corpus is available for you to take the expression to. That's the first part. Second part is that we have several doctrines in copyright law. One is called the fair use defense, which I think more and more people know about now, that you can take a certain amount. You can take a small amount. Certainly, we wouldn't be able to have literary criticism. We wouldn't be able to have much of what happens in the arts and sciences if it wasn't possible to quote a small amount of someone else's work. If your goal is criticism, if your goal is analysis, you will be more protected by the fair use doctrine. And the fair use doctrine also takes into account what we just heard Kerouac's work described as, and what I call in legal terms, transformative. The more transformative your new work is, the more it breaks new ground and goes into a new place, the more you can enjoy fair use rights to use pre-existing works, pre-existing expressions. So there's a number of doctrines that ameliorate what seem to be the author's strong control over his or her words.
Well, that word transformative may be a way of moving to the our next caller from we've got a little glitch there, so we're not going to do that. Okay, let me talk, if I can, to Malcolm about this in terms of changing it, that word transformative. That's in effect what you were saying, right?
Yeah, and this is my great objection to the way that journalists in particular talk about plagiarism. You know, plagiarism, to my mind, ought to be connected to some of these sophisticated notions about intellectual property. And it's not. Plagiarism has become this kind of blanket objection to even the smallest copying under any circumstances.
It's not a crime, is it? I mean, we wouldn't find that anywhere in the code, plagiarism. You know, you get 5 years for that.
But it is, you know, it is something that will get you fired at a newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember once insufficiently rewriting a phrase from a press release when I was at the Washington Post, and getting in so much trouble that I literally was scared for my job. And there's none of this. This happens time and time again. People lift banal phrases in newspaper articles, and they get, you know, they're pilloried and their careers are ruined. And there's never this kind of consideration. Well, what are you taking? How are you using what you're taking? You know, and all these are considerations that I think ought to be front and center and aren't.
You, when you were doing some research for how this is supposed to work, turned to the way that we see it or hear it frequently in music. Did you find a parallel there between the way that music can be borrowed and the way that words are borrowed?
Well, musicians are just a lot more accepting of the idea that creativity of necessity involves borrowing bits and pieces from here and there and putting them together in a new form. I mean, you know, you listen to a rock song and you can hear a guitar riff that you think comes from somewhere else. And Musicians actually, are fine with that.
There's one that you mentioned that we thought we would take advantage of to listen to it, and we start in 1969 with this well-known Led Zeppelin song.
You need cool air. Baby, I'm not fooling. I'm gonna send you back to school. Way down inside. Honey, you need it. I'm gonna give you my love. I'm gonna give you my love. Oh, what a whole lot of love.
Okay, so now that we've got those phrases stuck in your head for the rest of the day, listen to this. This is Muddy Waters from 7 years earlier.
You got yawning, and I got funny. Baby, you look so sweet and cunning. Baby, way down inside. Woman, you need love. Woman, you need love. You got to have some love. I'm gonna give you some love. I know you need love. Just got to have love. You got to have some love. Y'all make me feel so good.
1-800-423-8255, a conversation this hour about what's borrowed, what's stolen, what's plagiarism, what's copyright. We have with us on the program Malcolm Gladwell, who's writing about it in this edition of The New Yorker, and Justin Hughes, who is a lawyer specializing in this. So, Justin, first to you, in this case, could Muddy Waters have taken Robert Plant to court over this, saying you stole my music?
Well, one of the tests, or the final hurdle in proving copyright infringement is a test that's called substantial similarity. And it asks, does a lay person experiencing the defendant's work and the plaintiff's work think that they're substantially similar?
That's a jury's decision then? Or?
It's very interesting. In 20th century American law, it's regarded as very much for a jury, as long as the jury is properly educated on what they should be looking for. It's very complicated, but what I wanted to say about that is it's really easy with words for one of us to say, hey, those are the exact words. Those are the exact words. I heard those yesterday. I read those yesterday. It's harder with music. Baden sounds that substantially similar to me. I'm something short of tone deaf, but it seemed to me very musically different. An expert musician might say, hey, those are exactly the same in the following ways. But the basic doctrine in the U.S. would be we don't ask the expert. We ask a layperson, do those seem the same to you? And at least in this case, my ears are lay. And they say, well, I don't think that that's close enough.
Malcolm, what about you? What did you learn listening to these comparisons? Because you had a friend who sort of took you through a number of them.
Yeah. Well, there is a... it's clear that Led Zeppelin is inspired in that song by Muddy Waters, musically. And Led Zeppelin would be one of the first to admit that. But it's also clear that those are wonderfully different songs. I mean, Led Zeppelin has taken something and transformed it in precisely the way we want artists to transform older material. Now, I don't know what the... Legally, I'm not a lawyer, but I know that from the standpoint of someone who likes to listen to music, I'm happy they did that. And I don't think we should have any kind of system that stands in the way of someone taking old words and making them into something new.
So are you telling us that perhaps that same kind of attitude ought to be more a part of the sharing of words, sentences, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's only journalists. It is only self-righteous journalists who have this particular doctrine that says that copying under no circumstances or borrowing under no circumstances is a good thing. That's the puzzle that I kept coming back to. Why do I belong to a profession that has this fundamentalist, extremist notion about intellectual property?
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Terry's on the line. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I just think this is an incredibly timed program, at least from my perspective, because last night I sat down to write a play based on a work of pretty well-known scholarship that's ongoing based on some religious and philosophical research in a pretty high-profile way. I hesitate to say too much more about it because I don't want anybody to steal the idea, but I do want to talk about two things. First of all, you know, how much objectivity do you lose if you go to the people you want to sort of base your writing on and say, hey, can you cooperate in this? I think that's from a writer's perspective. From a lawyer's perspective, I'm just wondering, you know, how much how fictionalization would have to take place in order to sort of purge any taint of plagiarism or stealing from that piece of
Interesting question, Justin. I mean, if Terry went to the people who or the person who had written the material that he was interested in borrowing from, does he perhaps buy himself more trouble if that person says, then, no, don't touch it?
Okay, those are good questions. Well, but first, let me go back to something Terry said and connect it to something Malcolm said. Terry said he didn't want anyone to steal his idea, which just shows that it's not just journalists. It's a lot of artists and a lot of creative people who – Terry didn't say borrow my idea or use my idea.
Right.
And when you get out to Hollywood, you find an awful lot of people who feel their ideas are stolen all the time. So a lot of us have – strong feelings that when we have an original idea, it's ours. There's a possessory instinct that seems a lot more primal than copyright law.
Well, a lot of money at stake, too, potentially.
A lot of money at stake, but often a lot of pride.
Yeah.
All those scripts that are being written in cafes in Los Angeles, most of them don't generate much money, but they generate a lot of pride.
Okay.
But to go back to this particular problem, not only are ideas not protected by copyright law, facts are not protected. And if you are taking someone's principally factual work, a historical account, for example, and you're building a fictional work out of it, and you use all the first writer's claims as to what were the historical facts, you're fine. I'll give you a couple examples of that. Some of us are old enough to remember the CBS show Simon and Simon. And there's a famous case where Simon and Simon used the as a plot line a lot of the facts that were alleged about Dillinger. I think it was Dillinger in Chicago, the Chicago mobster, having actually survived when the feds came after him and having escaped to live in San Diego. And this theory, historical theory, had been put forward in a couple of books by a historian, and it became the plot line of a Simon and Simon television show. And the man sued, but the result was you claimed this was a historically accurate account, that this is what happened to Dillinger. And because of that, if Simon and Simon wants to pick that up as a motif, as their plot line, that's fine. Similar case involving the Hindenburg, that it wasn't an accident, that it was sabotage, and that became the subject of a feature film.
Just step in here for half a second, Justin. I want to come back to Malcolm on the idea of the ownership of the idea. Malcolm, would you be protective, as Terry just expressed it, if you were, you know, sitting around having lunch with a couple of other writers and said, I've got this great idea for something, and someone went, yeah, I might try that too.
Yeah, but the critical distinction is that Terry is protected because Terry hasn't written his play yet. I'd already written this article. I think there's a big difference between the protectiveness you feel before it's been published and the protectiveness you feel afterwards. I'm not going to tell anyone what I'm working on right now for The New Yorker. I'm very protective of it. But, you know, if you want to take that idea and transform it in some way once it's published, I'm perfectly happy for you to do that. So, you know, that's an important distinction, I think.
I wonder if there's also a distinction here. You work as a staff writer at The New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a freelancer, would you feel any different, where you basically had to make your living selling each piece?
Well, I wouldn't feel any different about this distinction about being protected before publication and being...
Right. I'm sorry. I should have been more clear.
So
whether
afterwards.
Or not you'd have been any more concerned about finding your work appearing in the play as a freelancer.
I don't think so. I am aware as a writer about how much I have benefited from the work and ideas, and in some cases the words of others.
Yeah.
And so this is why I find the attitude of many journalists so hypocritical when it comes to plagiarism. They have an absolute standard when it comes to someone using their work, but not an absolute standard when it comes to them using the work of others.
All right, to Middleton, Rhode Island for our next call. Lisa's on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What are you thinking?
I am a freelance writer, and I often see my work posted on various websites. you know, I often just do that as a scan to see who is buying my work and who isn't and who's posting it illegally. For instance, I do a story for the Boston Globe on, you know, arts or a dance, and a dance website will have posted my work. Now, in one way, I'm very flattered that they did this, but in another way, that sort of reduces the chances of me reselling that work because it's been posted and, you know, many people would be going to that website and reading it and so on.
I'm wondering, let's hear from Justin Hughes on whether or not the ease with which stuff can be bounced around and reprinted and copied on the Internet is something that's also being looked at in law now.
It's a huge issue, and in 1998, American copyright law was amended to permit a copyright owner to go to a company that's hosting a website for someone else that has infringing material on it and say, you need to take that down. And it's called notice and takedown provisions. And, of course, there could be times when someone claims that there's a copyright infringement, but there isn't. And then the person who has the website is allowed to say, no, put my material back up. Mm-hmm. So it's a system has been created from the late 90s to address these kinds of situations. In the case of a freelance writer, though, just a final thought on this, you've got to remember, quite often the freelance writer has transferred the copyright to someone else, to the magazine, to the newspaper. And in that case, although his or her name will still be attached to it, the right to object to unauthorized reproduction and distribution really belongs to whoever owns the copyright, not the author.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join our conversation this hour as we take stock of plagiarism and copyright and the American law that is there to protect people when they put words on paper, but also questions about whether or not you want to always try and take advantage of a law like that. 1-800-423-TALK to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
No, you need cooling. Woman way down inside. Woman, you need love. You got to have some love. You got to have some love.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. So who does own words, arranged in what order and at what length? Should writers, journalists lighten up a little bit, perhaps not be so quick to say, hey, those are mine? Or do you need to defend this turf? We're at 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, a lawyer who knows all about this, Justin Hughes, a professor of law at Cardozo Law School in New York City. Malcolm Gladwell's a staff writer for The New Yorker who's writing specifically about this in the current edition, commenting on a piece of his that was extensively borrowed from for a British play. We're going to take our next call from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Khan is joining us from there. Hi, Khan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What do you think?
I actually have a question for Professor Hughes in
Go
terms of intellectual property and the supposedly plagiarism or borrowing of that. I'm a trainer, and we find that in the training industry, there's a lot of times where you can go to a workshop and hear somebody present an idea, and many people take from that idea, and they go out and they put together their own workshop, and they go ahead and charge for that. And where's that line drawn when it comes to something like that?
Well, an idea, to protect an idea, you don't want copyright law. You go to patent law. And the reason for that is you have to go to the United States Patent and Trademark Office and show that you've crossed some pretty high thresholds of originality and creativity. For simple copyright, again, we'll go back to this idea-expression dichotomy. When you prepare training materials, the expression of your ideas are protected. But if someone has a new way of thinking about a problem, a management problem, an accounting problem, a human relations problem, it's only the expression of that idea that's protected by copyright law. And if someone goes to a training session, sees a cool idea, recasts it in his or her own words, and presents it again, then they're free to do that. Now, you know, if you have a 10-step process for identifying a problem, and someone comes to a training session and sees that, and lo and behold, next week they also have a 10-step process, but where you had said in one step, distribution, and they had said in one step dissemination. You still might, you might have a case against them, because even though they didn't use your literal words, again, we're drawing this line between idea and expression, and by copying your 10 steps in exactly that same order, they probably have come too close, and you've got a way to go against them.
Con, back to you in Baton Rouge. I mean, if you have people who say, can I do this, can I not, do you find it's a hard question to answer?
Yeah, it is. And a great example is when I went to see Tony Robbins, a lot of the stuff he presented came from Dr. Wayne Dyer, who was also his mentor, but again, he presented it, as Professor Hughes pointed out, in his own words and in his own style. But yet the idea and the process is the same.
And Malcolm, as I'm listening to Con, I'm thinking of, you know, we've just been through this ferocious political season where, you know, anybody's observation or clever six-word description, you know, of a candidate or a circumstance just gets, you know, traded up and down and spun all around on television and the Internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is just the way what we're describing is the way human beings work. I mean, this is how so much of our of expression, everyday expression, is based on sources that we don't even remember. But a lot of it came from somewhere. Only a small portion of what we do and say is truly original. Some would even say almost nothing is. I just think we need to be a lot more accepting of these chains of influence that take place in the creative process.
Let's go to Boston for our next call. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to take umbrage with a statement of boilerplate when we're talking about technical writing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a professor, and we have a very strict code for policy of plagiarism. We have a published web page that states that, you know, if we find plagiarism in a paper, the grade will turn into an F for the course. And they have very strong definitions where we talk about students needing to say things in their own words and not copying word for word or in part without giving credit.
What do you teach, Paul?
I teach biology.
And so we're dealing very specifically with really clear technical language here, right?
Correct. And with the advent of the Internet, students now are free to go to web pages and cut and paste sections of web pages into their lab reports or into their papers. And there's a lot of effort being put into departments to try and find people who are copying this information or, in fact, buying entire papers off of the web.
Can I ask you, just before I turn to Justin, though, I mean, if you're dealing with something really specific, like how one spore passes from this place to another, and there's a very simple, straightforward, elegant, easy-to-understand description in the textbook of how that process happens, don't you end up asking the student to make it more complicated by saying, sorry, you can't use those words?
Well, in some cases, we allow them to take a quote and then cite that quote.
Right, okay.
But we prefer students to be able to write it in their own words. You know, we can read something and say, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. I understand it. But until they sit down and try and write it out in their own words, they won't really understand the basic concepts. And we see that both in undergraduate and graduate education, where, you know, we're reading papers and trying to put a lot of information together to create new ideas, but we need to cite old ideas in order to develop our own logic.
Yeah, and Justin, Paul reminds us that while we're not just talking about professionals here, but the whole sort of student sphere of what you own and what we borrow, this is a completely different ballpark.
It is, and plagiarism has just exploded because of the availability of papers and documentation on the Internet, and it's a problem at every university. To go back to something Paul said and something you said, a lot of things have to be described in a particular way. Chemical formula probably only have one description. So a lot of the sciences we do, Paul may not like the phrase boilerplate, but we do have phrases that are the right phrases to use again and again, and to use any other phrase is wrong. Ferreting out when students are just, it's not just a question of when you ask a student to write that they actually do something original and creative. As Paul said, it's the process of them going through and recreating in their own expression these ideas, and plagiarism is rampant because of this the resources on the internet.
It reminds me, Malcolm, of an observation that you make in your new piece about the way that science has kind of figured out at the professional level this idea of when an idea deserves protection, to the point where, you know, there is that patent protection, so it's protected for a certain period of time. I'm wondering if you look at the thinking that went into the scientific side and think that maybe that would work more on the arts side as well.
You mean the idea of a much stricter time limit? I'm not
Well, sure. You talk about finding, you know, if you discovered a cure for cancer, for example, and someone had nicked that while it had a significant value or while it was brand new, that would have been against the law. But the way the system works, the law says, okay, after a certain period of time, mm-hmm. that idea is no longer your own.
Yeah. Well, we have that as Justin said, in the copyright, at a certain point, copyrights expire and ideas pass into the public realm. The question is that, in a lot of these discussions, I feel like we forget about the importance of the public realm. I mean, the reason that if you invent a cure for cancer, the reason that you have a patent that only lasts for 20 years is that we recognize that there is enormous value in letting your idea go free, in allowing people to take it, play with it, transform it, learn from it, do all kinds of things without the hindrance of a copyright owner, enforcing his or her legal protections. Mm-hmm. And we don't have that same – I want us to have that same notion, highly developed notion of the public sphere when it comes to words. And this is an idea that's been very powerfully argued by Lawrence Lessig in recent years, who's a law professor at Stanford and has written a number of really wonderful books on this. And I think it's something that we need to hear because we don't have the same sense of balance when it comes to the arts that people do on the other side on the scientific side.
Let's take a call from Arlington, Massachusetts now, and Ernie's on the line. Hi, Ernie.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. What are you thinking?
Well, there's one expression that I've not heard at all in this hour, and that's attribution. I am a writer, but I have not had much that's published, yet I have put out a lot of my thoughts online. Mm-hmm. And when I'm aware that thoughts are not my own, and when I know where they come from, I attribute them duly. And where the information is available, I will cite not only the author, but the copyright and the year of that copyright, not seeking to ascribe anything in that to myself. It never involves, let's say, copying a lengthy article or anything beyond, let's say, a song text or a poetic text. But
Arnie, how short would you go for that? If you'd cooked up a turn of phrase that you particularly liked, would you like to have someone borrow but attribute it to you as well?
Yes, that would be fine by me. In fact, there are instances when I have transformed thoughts, not in a way to mask that they're somebody else's, but when I can think of a way to bring new life to them.
Justin Hughes, is this a matter of good manners or is this a matter of law?
It's actually a matter of both. We would call that in law a right of attribution. But obviously, let's talk about the non-legal side first. You cure plagiarism by properly attributing ideas and expression to people. And much of academia is built on a system of attribution where it's attribution and scholarly notoriety, not money, that makes the system work. In terms of legal rights, there is a more developed system in Europe, in continental Europe, called moral rights, where there is a right of attribution to ensure that you are properly credited for your works. The development of rights of attribution in the United States are more inchoate. It's more a matter of we tend to put that stuff under unfair competition law and trademark law. But you should think of it as a question of a right of attribution, and it's both addressing plagiarism issues and authors' legal rights.
And there's an interesting observation that you make near the end of this current piece, Malcolm, about your meeting with the British playwright, Briony Lavery, and talking to her about the use of your words and Dorothy's story, because it's particular. It ends up a lot harder on her, law case or no.
Yes. Yeah, her reputation took a quite a savage beating as a result of this whole controversy. The story went out around the world about how she'd been accused of plagiarism, and that's a very hard thing for someone in the creative professions to hear, to deal with. But she also didn't quite understand what she'd done wrong, because she had, what's one of the points I make in the piece is that there was other material that she borrowed from other people that she did give attribution for. So it wasn't that she was opposed to giving attribution. She just never felt that the stuff she borrowed from me rose to the level where attribution was necessary. And I kind of agree with her, to be honest. That's why I sort of, in the end, ended up being on her side. I sort of feel like it was a little unfair. She just didn't think she thought the stuff she was using from me was so kind of basic that it was facts, as Justin said. It seems to me that that's probably an accurate or at least a defensible argument.
And time maybe that we back down a little bit from the gotcha nature of plagiarism. I'm thinking of the stories about Lawrence Tribe and Doris Kearns Goodwin and people like that.
Yeah, let's reserve that term for cases where people take a lot of material that's of particular importance to the originator and they use it in a way that is not transformative. Those are my rules. If you're writing a history of Winston Churchill and you borrow 5,000 words from a previous history of Winston Churchill, I think that's a bad idea and we got to go after you. You're not doing anything transformative. But in this case, she did something. She took a little piece of mine and she made something entirely new. And that strikes me as being in a completely different ballpark.
Well, and you've given us a new way to think about it. I appreciate you being with us. Thanks, Malcolm.
Thank you.
Malcolm Gladwell is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His latest article is called Something Borrowed. And Justin Hughes, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Justin's a professor of law at Cardozo University. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Kevin Sullivan, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoberg, and Killian Nolan. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. We will go out listening to a little bit of Whiter Shade of Pale by Procol Harum, based on a little bit of Bach, Air on the G String. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.